Welcome to the Nerdist Podcast number 750. I am performing a handful more shows through the end of the year leading up to my Fun Comfortable special taping in San Francisco on January 29th, Los Angeles on the 24th, and then coming weeks, the rescheduled Phoenix show in Salt Lake City, and there's a couple of more, so go to funcomfortabletour.com to get ticket links and info. And now, here's the Nerdist Community Cork Board. A comedian in the Bay Area writes, a fellow comedian and dear friend to all was walking to his car at 16th and Mission in San Francisco when he was stabbed in the heart and stomach. This happened around 3 a.m. Monday. He had two surgeries and is on his way to recovery at SF General Hospital. He runs a weekly open mic and has already been struggling financially. His name is Jamie Phillips, a.k.a. Frosty Nugs. We set up a GoFundMe for him that can be found by going to GoFundMe.com and searching Helping Out Frosty Nugs. Aw, man, get better, dude. Next, we are guys at GetHotSauced.com, and we're here to provide the experience of making your own hot sauces to the masses. We provide make-your-own hot sauce kits that include everything you need to make three bottles of hot sauce in your kitchen. Make your own spicy mustard and ketchup are coming soon, and they just started their newest private labeling venture, LabelYourSauce.com. They can create custom labels on a variety of hot sauces, barbecue sauces, ketchups for events, weddings, gifts, giveaways, anything else you need to spice things up. Our hot sauce donation page is now live as well. We donate bottles of hot sauce to local food kitchens for every case of hot sauce we sell. Check out GetHotSauced.com. Now, you know, a little bit of a juxtaposition between a poor guy getting stabbed and hot sauce. Again, Frosty Nugs, get better, dude. Glad you're okay. All right, this episode is David Goyer, who has probably written several things that you've watched, whether or not you knew that he wrote them. But we'll get into all that. He's promoting the final season of Da Vinci's Demons, premiering this Saturday, the 24th, at 8 p.m. on Stars. So if you're not coming to the comedy show that I'm doing, then watch Da Vinci's Demons. Here's Nerds Podcast number 750 with David Goyer. Katie, please roll the thing.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
She had a t-shirt, though, that it had, like, 12 popular Time Machine stuff. So there was, like, the TARDIS, the car, and I'm trying to think of, like, other Time
Machines. H.G. Wells' Time Machine, I'm sure.
Bill and Ted's Phone Booth, which was a nod to...
And it was, and most of them I could identify, but there were, like, a couple I was like, I don't know what that
is. Was one of them the Enterprise slingshotting around the sun?
No that would have burst. First of all, that would have been a Klingon Bird of Prey slingshotting
around the sun. Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, I'm sorry. Yes, come on. I apologize. No, you're right.
The Enterprise would just take the readings from the Borg ship and open up a temporal vortex using the deflector array.
No, they're going to divert power to the... What are they going to do? Redirect power to the...
They reroute main power through the secondary coupling.
That's right.
Because that coupling's always around, ready to go. Welcome to the Nerdist Podcast, David Goyer.
David Goyer. Right. Yes, we've started. You can say anything you want. And let me just, first of all, say that you wrote two movies that I watched so many times... That I fucking love so much.
Kickboxer 2.
Kickboxer 2, Death Warrant. No. Dark City.
Yes.
And Blade. Fucking great.
Beautifully.
Both
done.
Came out the same year?
Same year, 98.
Yeah.
I when those came out on DVD, they were just in an alternating loop.
Nice.
Blade was so fucking fantastic, and Dark City. I worked at K-Rock at the time, and I had a Dark City... I still have, like, a Dark City promo t-shirt.
Whoa.
Where he's Rufus Sewell is... And it says, Sleep Now. You know,
the crazy thing is, it's actually not Rufus Sewell on that poster.
What?
Yeah.
Everything I'd believed was a lie.
I mean, it's supposed to be the character, but they had to cobble it together, and it's actually...
Tim Robbins and Shawshank.
No. It's a... Sean, one of my college roommates, was working for like the company that did the poster together at the time, and he posed, and they sort of photoshopped like his face on, because they couldn't get Rufus like in for the
That's amazing. And Kiefer Sutherland does that just that the whole time. Well, John, you see, they are the strangers.
He's doing Whatchamagoo from He's doing Peter Lorre.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes. Yeah. It's so that I love that movie so much.
So does Roger Ebert.
Now, why didn't that movie make $1 billion? It's such an inventive, weird...
It came out... it was a little ahead of its time, and it's funny because one of the producers and a fair amount of the crew were on The Matrix, and VFX company subsequently on the first Matrix film. And I just think it was like, and they share some similarities, but it just came out a little ahead of its time. Yeah. We didn't have a big star, you know.
Right.
Rufus wasn't, you know.
But Jennifer Connelly was a big star at that time, wasn't she?
That was in the dip.
Ish, and then I don't know. It's just one of those. You know, it's funny because that year, you know, the movie was very well reviewed and did terribly at the box office. And then Blade, people don't remember this, but did great at the box office and was horrifically reviewed. I mean, it was just the first Blade film was just completely savaged.
Really?
Savaged. And then the second Blade film came out, and then like sort of like one of the only good reviews we got at all from the first Blade film was like Sight and Sound, that like
yeah, the magazine that would rate the picture and sound quality. Yeah.
That fucking first scene where he goes to the meat locker rave with Tracy Lords, and then just Donald Logue is amazing in that movie.
Amazing in it.
And Stephen Dorff is really great in that, and as Deacon Frost.
I maintain it's the best Dorff's ever been, but Donald Logue is great.
I prefer Dorff on golf.
Stephen Dorff on golf. Stephen Dorff on golf would be a great. Video series.
It sure was.
Yeah.
No, but it should be Stephen Dorff. Yeah. Hey, where's my fucking caddy?
No, it should be Dorff on Dorff.
You mean I can't smoke on the golf course? We're all adults here.
Why hasn't that been made yet? Dorff on Dorff. And get fucking Tim Conway to get on his knees and hang around with Stephen Dorff for the day.
Tim Conway's up there. If he got on his knees, he might not get back up.
I think he's spry.
I was actually going to ask if he were still alive.
No, I think Tim Conway's still alive. He's probably still really funny, too. But those two movies... Now, let me ask you about Dark City.
Still really funny. That's a great sentence.
He's probably still really funny.
He's probably still really funny.
He's probably still really funny.
No, you're like...
Because
the
level of funny Tim Conway was, I don't know if that goes away.
Yeah.
He's just like Ebenezer Scrooge, and he's like super mean.
I don't know.
I'm not, and I've never met him, so I don't know.
No, I think there are some people who are just... I think there are some people who are funny for work, and I think there are some people who are just funny. I think Tim Conway's just funny.
I suspect he's funny.
Now, was there a much longer initial cut of Dark City? Because it feels like in places like it jumps around a little bit, and you're like, okay, well that feels like it.
Yeah, and there was also they released a kind of director's DVD there was definitely a longer cut.
It's so good. I really that's one of those movies that I really one of my favorite movies of the 90s, and it's a movie that I hope people go back and see if they haven't seen it yet.
If you're like a film enthusiast, I have to say it's of all the things I've worked on, it's probably, you know, if you're like a real film nerd, like that's the one that people, you know, dig.
Mm. Was it Alex Proyas?
Uh-huh.
Who did The Crow?
Yep.
Right? And it just – it's a
– I mean, if you want to – not that we have to get on a Dark City tangent, but so – Alex reached out to me. He wrote like a treatment for Dark City and asked me if I would like flesh out the script, write the script. And I read the treatment. It was like 16 pages long, and it was brilliant, but it was just all over the place. And he knew that. And The Crow had not come out yet. Mm. And I passed on it because I was just like, this is – crazy, but like I didn't have a context for Alex, and so he went off, and The Crow subsequently came out, and I thought was amazing. And at the time, he got Lem Dobbs, who wrote Kafka among other things, to flesh it out into a screenplay, and it's fine because we're all friends now. But Lem was not the perfect guy to unobfuscate. Do you know what I mean? Like, and so then it came back to me like a year later, and at that point I'd seen The Crow, and then I also have this fixation for Australia, and Proyas had said, we'll come to Australia for like a month and we'll hang out, and that was kind of that sunk it for me. But I just remember that the whole thing with Dark City when we were in Australia for the first time was I said, it's totally fine that like this world have different rules than Earth. It's just that the rules have to be consistent.
Right.
And so we went through this whole thing of like, what are the rules? And just making sure that they're consistent. And the first thing I said was, you can't have a movie called Dark City in which there's never daylight and at some point not have someone comment on the fact that it's never day. And that's how that scene with William Hurt – there's a big pivotal scene in the film where they start talking about the fact that there's no day and William Hurt's character is like, oh, yeah. There isn't any day. What's up with that? You know, and we sort of worked backwards from that. Anyway.
Yeah, it's a great movie and people should watch it if they haven't. But you did write Death Warrant.
I did.
Which, when you were in school, right? Did you leave school or did you finish school?
I finished school and I actually wrote that about 3 months after. Because what had happened was I finished school and that summer Die Hard had come out.
Mm-hmm.
And... I had not initially thought of writing action films. And Die Hard had come out, and I thought, oh, maybe I'll try to write an action spec. And so I was like, oh, it'll be Die Hard, because everything was Die Hard in a blank.
Yeah.
So this was like Die Hard in a prison. And I wrote that, and it sold immediately and went into production.
And did pretty well, I think.
At the time, I think until 7, it was MGM's most successful film of all time. It's the only movie I actually have received when you sign a contract to write a film. Like they give you net points on the film, net profits of which are completely non-existent. And I actually saw – it made so much money because I think we spent $4 million in it. Ended up making $35 domestically and a bunch of – it made so much money that I actually saw net –
congratulations.
Profits, because it was like they couldn't hide it all.
And for those listening, like if you those net profit deals, like Return of the Jedi supposedly has never gone into net profit.
Back to the Future.
Yeah, yeah.
The Future has
never gone into net profit.
All of these are like, oh yeah, this isn't in profit. We totally lost money on Star Wars.
How do they get away with that accounting stuff?
Just
no, I know it's
shady accounting.
But so was, you know, but so was old Chicago in the 30s was accounting.
So here's we spent $40 million on this one bus ad.
Yeah. Because the way it works is that you – on stuff that's profitable, anything that's genuinely profitable is you get together with a couple of people and you audit them and there's usually a settlement.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because, you know, all these movies that are supposedly not profitable, I'm sure – At the end of the fiscal year or whenever they make their financial, I was like, oh, look how well we did this year. Like, wait, but all your movies haven't technically made any money.
Well, also things that don't, you know, initially make profit in like the first cycle, like over the life of the film, like as it goes now on a VOD or DVD or it becomes a library thing and then they sell the library, stuff can make a profit 10 years later, you know, eventually, because there's all these sort of additional revenue streams. Not that I'm sure your listeners want to hear about that, but
no, actually, it is very interesting because it is when you think about the most successful movies of all time, and you think, oh my god, all those people must have gotten really like, well, someone did, but
usually not the artist or the artists involved.
John Peters did,
yeah.
But did you work with Van Damme directly?
No, Van Damme bought the script.
Oh, he bought it himself.
Yeah, here's the amazing thing. So I was at the time...
with crumpled up wads in his jeans.
I think I have a $100,000 bill here.
I was at the time, briefly after school, I was a PA at a now defunct studio, MTM Studios, Mary Tyler Moore Studios, and they made a bunch of stuff. And they were over at where CBS Radford is now. And so I was the guy that would deliver mail around the lot and also like... deliver like sodas to the offices and crap like that. And I had like a hand truck that I would go around. So I wrote this script and my agent at the time called me, left a message for me at work and called me and said, do you know who Jean-Claude Van Damme is? And at the time, I think only Cyborg and Bloodsport had come out or something like that. And I said, no. And I remember he like, you could hear him like open the newspaper and he said, there's like a 3 o'clock showing at the Man's Chinese Theater or the Chinese Theater at the time. Go see it now, and he's going to meet you at like 5:30. and so I saw the Cyborg at the Chinese Theater, which was terrible, but like whatever. And then I went over and I met with him. And he, at the time, he had – this is back in like 88 or 89. He had one of those giant – like military cell phone, like the first cell phone I'd ever seen. It was like it was like 80 pounds, and I was like, "What is that?" And he was like, "It's a cell phone," and I didn't even know what it was. Anyway, he gave me. I have to say this for him. I walked in the room. He gave me a big hug, and he said, "I'm terrible at at Accents, but he was like, you're going to be a big star. And he said, Hollywood will rip you up, but I will protect you like an eagle. And he made these like eagle cloth marks.
What does that mean?
I don't know. But he...
he's still doing it. You just don't know.
He's protecting
He's looking over you.
I'm...
He's the one that's just blown everything in the right direction for you this whole time, and you didn't even know it.
And he's
up at Warner Brothers,
but 10 weeks later, we were making the movie, and I was the only writer, and I was on the set, and you know, he was, you know, so I owe him that.
Did he ask you for another draft, or we just go, yeah, let's do this?
The only thing we had to do, because his English was even not as good as it is now, and we had to take. I immediately had to take most of his dialogue and reapportion it to other characters like throughout in the script. And then we did this bullshit thing. He was supposed to be an American cop, and he was actually French Canadian, like an RCMP, like on loan for like to explain the accent. But
listen, by the way, I appreciate that kind of thing. That's why Red Heat's so great. It's the only one that tries to explain Schwarzenegger's accent.
We made an attempt.
By the way, you were lucky you had Van Damme with you at the Chinese Theater at that time, because that stretch of Hollywood Boulevard was not a great place
in 1989. It was a crappy area.
Like, they hadn't refurbished the theater across. There was no Hollywood Highland. It was really just like fucking drugs and...
And I'm not kidding. So the Chinese Theater is a giant theater, right? But if you went to like a matinee on a Wednesday, it was completely empty. Mm-hmm. And there was somebody like doing drugs and somebody beating off, and like it just
it's still like that now. It's just those people are dressed as Spider-Man and SpongeBob.
There you go.
That guy is still jerking off at Terminator.
I've been jerking off years. Where's my star in the Walk of Fame?
Cyborgs get me.
Do you remember a filmmaker named Jack Shoulder?
No,
he directed The Hidden and like Nightmare on Elm Street 2 and stuff like that. He had like a lot of stuff for New Line, and I remember him telling me just randomly that he went to see one of his first films in Times Square, like at the time when Times Square was sort of like, and like midway through his movie, like this guy just jumped up and said, make it stop, and started beating his head against the wall like during the screening. So I was like, now that's a review.
Is it because it feels like with writing for film, once you kind of get in, once you have a movie that does pretty well, you're pretty much – does it seem like you're in the machine for a while, or do you feel like you constantly have to keep proving yourself over and over again? Because we have friends like Tom Lennon who has fucking scripts everywhere, a lot of which probably won't get made, but it doesn't matter.
I mean, I have a lot of friends who make a healthy living and have never had anything made.
Right.
And if you get something made and it's a decent hit – I don't think you can coast on that forever, and you're sort of just in the club, but it's hard enough to get anything made, much less be a hit. So if you've had something, one hit, it will be much easier to get work.
You can't coast on it forever unless it's blank check.
Yes. Right. Yes. But you can still like squander it, you know. You can it can dry up. It's certainly easier for me now than when I started.
I would imagine.
And if you've had a few successful films, then they think, oh, he must know something.
Well, I mean, I would say The Dark Knights were pretty. Batman Begins were pretty. Those were pretty successful movies.
They were,
that you wrote.
Well, also, I think for me, it's that I've done it a few times. So it's like Blade had, you know, was a really obscure character that, you know, had a trilogy of films and three video games and blah, blah, blah. And then Batman, and everyone says, oh, but Batman's easy to do. But like the previous Batman to Batman Begins was not doing well.
People forget. People forget. Just the same with Iron Man, where they forget.
Exactly.
Oh, well, you know it now because for 10 years it's been an institution in the superhero film universe. But before that, Iron Man was not a character in the forefront, and Robert Downey Jr. was not working.
No.
And Batman Begins, I think part of the reason that it blew up so much is that people were pretty burned by
Batman and Robin.
Right.
But also we got lucky in that the Batman and Robin had not done well, and by the time we came along, and there had been a lot of people who had attempted to do Batman films in the interim, like Mark Protasevich had written another one, and there was going to be an R-rated Aronofsky, one, and Boaz Yakin was going to do Batman Beyond, and then Andy Kevin Walker did like a Batman Superman. There were all these like stillborn Batman things that had not happened in the intervening period. And so by the time Chris and I came along, they knew they had to do something radical.
Yeah.
And they were kind of like so desperate. I just remember when I got the job, everyone was saying, both online and amongst my friends, oh, it'll never get made.
Right.
It'll never get made.
Well, that smart money was it on it not getting made.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Well, because at that point, when you heard Batman, it was like, ah, boy.
Yeah.
Here we go.
And we knew that we were – it's funny because if you look at the box office for that film versus The Dark Knight,
yeah,
we knew that we were coming in from a deficit. Like there was a negative connotation to the character that – so we had to get – past that, much less it even being a good movie. Anyway,
and so how
it turned out okay.
How did like what did you have some sort of a guiding principle that were you writing from a reactionary place to the previous film?
The guiding principle is Batman doesn't kill. That's the guiding principle.
But I mean, were you writing from a place of like it has to be different from this, or was it, you know, let's just throw all that away and we'll just start over with a whole different vision of it?
We were aware that it had to be radically different, but that said, that wasn't the guiding principle, because I don't think you can create something just as a reaction to something. So the guiding principle was what if we play it straight?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that was really it. And then sort of, you know, reverse engineer it down to everything, like the utility, no pun intended, the utility belt or the Batmobile. So like the previous Batmobiles that had been in the Burton films, that was not a practical car. Like it looked like I remember
you
could seeing
see it wobble.
You could, yeah, and you could barely like turn a corner. Right.
That's why it had to fire grappling hooks into the wall. So yeah, it would turn
exactly.
Corner.
Exactly. And so we just said, okay, what if it's real? So like, even like the cowl had, you know, like listening devices in it and stuff like that, or like the classic example is. You know, like the little design features on his gauntlet. We were at DC in New York, and I remember asking Paul Levitz, who was the publisher of DC at the time. I said, "What are those things?" And he said, "Oh, we call them scallops. Like, but they're just." I said, "Do they have like a function?" And he said, "No, they're just a design feature." And Chris was like, "No way." And I remember flying back from New York, and we were talking about what had to be in the film or on the costume versus not. And I said, I think those things have to be there. And Chris said, then you better fucking figure out what they do. or else we're not putting them on. And that's how we came up with the idea of them being rigid and then being both a offensive and defensive thing where you could trap a sword blade and break it. And so that the guiding principle was just, what if it were real?
You were justifying everything. You were justifying all of the comic.
Yeah,
that's
so funny. I don't even question what the gauntlets do.
But until that point, and now the comic books adopted
it. Yeah.
But until that point, no one had ever just thought about, huh, what if it's real? And then the other thing was that our points of reference when we were making that film weren't other comic book films. They were The Man Who Would Be King or, you know, Lawrence of Arabia or things like that.
Wow.
Can we just talk for 1 second about Nick Fury, Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D.?
Sure. Yes. Which I'll which sometimes – and I love like when somebody writes on the internet, like they'll cherry pick your credits. Like it'll say David S. Goyer, Nick Fury, Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D. like in parentheses. Like that's all I've ever done. And I'm just like, you fucking asshole. You
know? It's such a snarky thing to do. Look what this guy did.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you know what Nick Fury Agent of S.H.I.E.L.D. is?
No.
Okay, I want you to shut your eyes for a second. I want you to forget what you know.
I will explain it, but
please,
go on.
No, of course. Yeah. I want you to shut your eyes and forget what you know about Nick Fury now. What if Nick Fury was David Hasselhoff? And what if David Hasselhoff.
Hang on, but Hasselhoff looks like the original Nick Fury in the comics.
But
so
what if David Hasselhoff as Nick Fury had basically an android double in the story?
Well, he'd have to stop that double.
An LMD, a life model decoy.
A life model decoy. Yeah. So it's amazing because it's. I mean, it shows. And by the way, I do want you to know that usually when you say like, well, look at, you know, look how far superhero movies have come, and in the 90s they weren't really in that great of a state, and then you can always go, but Blade was really rad, you know. So but what's the story behind?
So the story is hopefully, I mean, you'd all like to think that like the first script you write or something, you'll be really lucky and you'll have a lot of creative control and ownership, or you can just write whatever it is that you want. But the truth is, usually what happens is you kind of stumble through some not great projects and something's okay, and then you get a little bit more control. And so early on in my career, I mean super early on, I want to say I'd only been writing professionally for like 2 years. I believe Marvel was owned by New World at the time. Remember them?
Yeah. Oh, wow.
And New World was a sort of, I think, an extension of like the Canon Group, like Golan and Globus, mm-hmm. that had done like all those cheesy like movies in the 80s. You remember?
Wow.
So Marvel was in bankruptcy and was not a particularly valuable asset. And so there was this move at the time to like take some of the, I guess, second tier. In fact, during this period, they made that Captain America film. Remember that was made? Yeah, that was during this period. And so I was a young writer, and they wanted to do Nick Fury because they reasoned that Nick Fury could be, it wouldn't be as expensive because he was a super spy and things like that. So ostensibly,
the overhead is an eye patch.
Yes, yes. So ostensibly, I was going to write like what would then be a sort of under $10 million film. Mm. And I'm like a, you know, 23-year-old writer who loved like the Steranko, you know, Nick Fury comic book. So and my script was pretty, you know, Hydra was in it, and Baron von Strucker, and the Satan Claw, and LMDs, and Arnim Zola, and it was very much influenced by like Kirby and Steranko and all this stuff. And they didn't make it, so fair enough. And then, you know, some few years later, somehow that stuff got, as a group, got sold to Fox to be made as four made-for-TV movies. And then they said, great news. Like, we're going to take your old script and we're going to make it. And David Hasselhoff wants to star in it. And they said, we want to fly you up to Vancouver to do the rewrites. And I just said, no. Which I'm kind of amazed that even relatively young in my career, like I did have like limits. Like I just said, somebody else rewrote me. I don't even know who, and I had no involvement in making it. And that's how I'm in.
So that's an interesting point to tackle, is that things go through so many hands, so many rewrites, and a lot of times you don't even really see everyone. If you just go to an IMDb page,
there are
people that you don't, because you know, I would hear these stories like, Quentin Tarantino got $1 million to write a 6-minute scene in blah,
Crimson
blah, blah.
Tide.
In Crimson Tide.
Yeah.
And, you know, so that it constantly goes through, there are so many hands that something can go through.
You don't always know, based on the screen credits, that those, I mean, they may have been responsible for it, or they may not have. I've written on movies that I'm uncredited.
Yeah.
Where they call it script doctoring, where it's done anything from, like, write a scene to write a week, punch up dialogue on something, or do a couple of weeks. And that can actually be fun kind of work, because you're sort of like a hired gun, and you're just coming in and you're sort of surgically trying to do.
You don't have any emotional attachment.
Exactly. And you're just trying to like.
I've done it a couple of times. Yeah. It's the best job you can
do. I kind of enjoy
no
it.
No pressure.
I kind of enjoy it. Yeah. And but you know, and I've had projects where someone else has come in, you know, for a few weeks and punched things up, and you know, yes. So that was an instance where I don't even know who rewrote that.
Could have been Hasselhoff.
Well, it could have been.
He's here today. Yeah. Come on out.
Yeah.
But it's interesting as a writer how many different ways, because I think, you know, when you're young, you go, oh, well, a writer is someone who you write a thing and then it makes a movie. But ultimately, there's so many ways that you can survive as a writer without necessarily, you know,
getting something made
before that thing actually gets made, which to me is still such a miracle that anything ever gets made because of the process.
I often say, sometimes I'll speak at schools or things like that, and I'll say, you know, if you knew how many opportunities there were for a movie to go off the rails at any given point during the making of it, you'd be amazed that anything good ever gets made. Mm. I mean, you would just be amazed. But yeah, I mean, it's the other thing is that there are some really good writers out there who have had three or four things made that are terrible movies, and they're really good writers. Like if you actually read the original script, you just like, oh my God, you just feel bad for this person because like whatever, you know, crazy star this or producer that, you know, screwed it up. So
I mean, do you have to go into this business as a writer with a certain amount of relinquishing control for
yeah. And you hope, look, if you want complete control, write a novel, you know, and if you don't want anyone to rewrite you, write a book. It's partly because it's a, and you hope that as you continue on in your career, I mean, there's no question that I am rewritten less now than I was at the beginning, but I'm still rewritten occasionally. And there are instances where someone, a friend of mine has rewritten me and I've rewritten that friend. And, but the other thing that you have to realize is even if you're making something relatively inexpensive, even if you're making a, you know, a micro budget horror film for $4 million, right? They're spending $4 million and then maybe another $25 million to market it. So mm-hmm. they're spending close to $30 million on something you wrote. So it's not like if you write a novel and you self-publish it or even someone publishes it, the money involved in getting that thing out to market is relatively minor. Even a small film, you still have to like get someone to spend $30 million of something. So by its very nature, there's going to be compromise.
Right.
And there are going to be other people that have an opinion. You know, I remember at one point the apex of it was we were shooting Man of Steel at the same time Chris was finishing Dark Knight Rises. And I call my wife one time from the set and I said, because I calculated like those two budgets and I think like I have my name on like over $600 million of stuff that's being made at Warner Brothers right now. And it's that was kind of crazy. You know, that was like the apex of like – not to mention all the marketing that went into that.
Oh, my God. But, you know, now your name is also on billions of dollars worth of stuff at the same time.
Yeah.
I mean, do you – you can't really stop to think too much about that though, right? I mean, you can have a moment where you're like, hey, that's really neat. All right, you better get back to work.
Yeah, I mean, obviously it flits through your mind sometimes, but you at the end of the day, you still have to try to do the best film that you can do. And I think for me, the lesson of Batman Begins and The Dark Knight is these – certainly by the time that we did The Dark Knight, this was like a big budget thing where, you know, the studio was hoping to make – you know, between merchandising and whatnot, billions of dollars. And there's the tendency to want to protect against failure and like, oh, well, why don't you guys, or A, why don't you guys just sort of do the same thing that you did the first time, but different, or you don't want to be too edgy. And I mean, the lesson for us was you can still have this massive, massive, massive film, this cultural phenomenon, and I think still do something that's really uncompromising. We didn't compromise in any way because we thought, oh, this will be a blockbuster, so we have to compromise. I think most of the time people feel like they do have to compromise or they should compromise.
Yeah. Well, I mean, but the, especially the first two were sort of fun stories because, you know, the audience perception before, because obviously everyone loves to judge things before they see them. But the perception before Batman, oh, and then seeing it, oh, and then I remember when Heath Ledger was cast, and it was like, what?
Oh yeah, oh yeah,
what? Are you fucking kidding me?
Yeah.
That guy, that handsome guy, what? And then, oh,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
And now he's sort of the now he is the definitive, you know, at least live action Joker.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, it being able to surprise an audience in that way is a very because it's very hard to surprise people anymore. Everyone's seen everything
and everyone prejudged. That's why I mean I prejudge too as a it's hard not to. I even when the first Blade film came out, I mean that movie before it came out was a joke. I mean people were saying this is like Spawn 2 or something like that and which is a perfectly fine comic book, but it was a that people were just laughing about that film and I had seen it. You know what I mean? And I was in the first test screening with the blood coming down. And like, you could feel the audience going, oh, holy shit. What the fuck is this? And I knew that that's what the movie was like. And all these people on the internet were like, me. And I had a similar feeling when we were doing Batman Begins and The Dark Knight. And I mean, I'd seen Heath doing the performance and I knew how amazing it was.
Also, Blade, Udo Kier, fucking great.
Yes.
Udo Kier, awesome. I mean, top to bottom, that movie is fantastic. And even, you know, I want to talk to you a little bit about sequels and sequelitis and how much, you know, because Blade 2 obviously was also fantastic because you had Guillermo and also just the idea of the vampire.
Yeah.
And, but this. When you're making a sequel, and it's sort of like what you said, well, for the next one, they want it to be different enough, but the same enough. And, you know, it seems like the formula for sequels is, well, I guess we got to raise the stakes somehow to get people to leave their homes again. So let's add 10 characters, 10 storylines. We'll just, you know, it feels like and audiences are savvy to it now. Like, okay, you just tried to throw a bunch of shit in there to just make it seem more marketable.
And I think they're also savvy to the idea that oh, this isn't a film. It's a piece of commerce now in this ongoing franchise where right. we're sort of, you know, if you go to the studios now, everyone's wants story universes. You know, that's the phrase. It's, you know, because they've seen what Marvel's done or – you know, what, you know, the Star Wars universe, Lucasfilm, and not to say that what Marvel and Lucasfilm haven't done is amazing. It's now that everyone, all the other studios want to do the exact same thing. And so you've got, whether they're successful or not, all these different studios saying, how do we come up with our own linked universe?
Right.
And so now it's not just enough to say, like, oh, I hope this is a 3-movie franchise. It's like, oh, I hope this is like a 9-movie or, you know, it's a 10-year plan.
It's so crazy.
It is crazy because you can't – and you've got all these projects, and I won't name them, that are sort of going out there that's like, this is going to be the first in a projected 8-movie thing. And you're like, dude, how about starting with just making a good movie?
The first time.
Yeah.
I mean, I think the idea –
hear that, Jupiter Ascending?
I was even going to say the idea of a trilogy is – daunting because
a presumptive trilogy,
you know, like, rarely is the third of anything like people have already seen the characters, they get it. It's almost like the third in a trilogy feels like, well, this is purely ceremonial, we just need 3 to round out the but yeah, you're right,
it's incredibly hard. I mean, there have been a lot of good sequels,
yeah,
and it's really hard to do a third film unless it's something like Lord of the Rings where it was 3. Yeah, books to begin with.
Right.
You know, it's incredibly hard to do it the third time out because you're, no matter what, you're sitting there going, well, what iteration, especially if you're not designing them to be one long story, which, like in the Batman films, we weren't. Mm-hmm. I mean, we weren't saying, oh, let's, like when we finished The Dark Knight, we didn't say, hey, we're going to do this, you know, or we've set these seeds to do X, Y, and Z. I mean, we had no idea what we were going to do. And it's hard. It's hard to find that balance between if you don't have a plan per se, because Chris always felt like each movie has to have its own integrity. And if you have a great idea, use it and don't think about a sequel.
Yeah.
And if you do that really well, it becomes harder to do a sequel. But at the same time, if you're trying to do a presumptive trilogy, I think audiences are starting to catch on to this. And I am, as an audience member, be a little weary of it.
What's the most interesting thing about Chris Nolan, how he works, his process? I mean, obviously, when you see a Nolan movie, you go, oh, yeah, that's a Christopher Nolan movie. Even though it's difficult to say exactly what it is that makes a Christopher Nolan movie.
I mean... As a collaborator, he's super rigorous and thoughtful. And I would say the one defining characteristic of those movies is that he really believes in not talking down to the audience. Like he thinks sometimes, no, you got to pay attention. Like he doesn't like to make things. He has a lot of faith in the audience.
Yeah. Well, I mean, look at Interstellar. Yeah. There's a lot of faith. Yeah. If anyone else, if he'd been able to get notes on that, they would have been like, it's too much science. You can't get people. You can't have people calculating timelines. You know, like Einstein.
Yeah.
Theory, you know, they would. That movie would have been probably an hour shorter and not made a lot of sense.
Yeah, I mean, he, you know, in general, like as you're making movies at the studios, it used to be in the old days that you had one or two people who would decide, I want to make this film. Like Blade and Darkseid were both made in the heyday of New Line when there was Bob Chapek at the time. Michael DeLuca was the guy who was basically saying, I want to make this. And he wasn't doing it based on profit and loss statements on what other films. Mm-hmm. He would just – if he liked it, he would make it. And on paper, Blade made no sense whatsoever. But he just liked it. And then –
Yeah, I mean, it's a daywalker already.
Yeah. But now what happens is now there are green light committees at studios. And they're getting bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. And so it's like now there's like – 10 people or 20 people or 30 people who weigh in on whether or not a film should get made. And then I think by its nature, the more people that you have weighing in, you know, the more sort of like all the interesting nooks and crannies and bumps get planed off and it can become more generic and risk averse. And so I think with Chris, it's like he just fortunately he's got to a place in his career where he can just say, no, I want to do this. And I know on paper it doesn't make any sense, but – I want to do it, and I have faith in the audience.
Are you concerned at all that we're getting superhero fatigue or at least like, you know, just feeling like, okay, Tobey Maguire, Spider-Man. Okay, now it's Andrew Garfield. Well, now it's another guy. Well, now that was – okay, that was Christian Bale. Now it's Ben. Or was it – you know what I mean? Like does it – do you are you worried that people are just going to be like, superhero movies?
Well, sure, and I think at a certain point you say – well, I mean – the period between reboots is like getting shorter and shorter and shorter and shorter. It used to be like you needed 20 years and then it was 10 and then it was like 8 and then it was 6 and now it's like 2, you know? And it used to be that like at least it was like a new generation that were
teaching it.
Exactly. And so, I think about that. I also think about there's so many superhero films getting made. Like in my wildest dreams when I was growing up, in a million years, I never would have imagined that there would be like a Blade film or a Guardians of the Galaxy film.
Right.
I mean, these were tertiary Marvel characters. You know, I don't even know what the word is. Yeah. But they probably will be, or there's going to be an Inhumans film. But having said that, I also loved Guardians. Yeah. And I think. Don't quote me exactly, but I think 2017, between like the Marvel films and the DC films and the Marvel films that are being done for Sony and or Fox, yeah. I think there's like 10 Marvel or DC films scheduled to come out that year. There's almost one every month. And so you do think, my God, how, you know, is there a saturation point? I have no idea.
We'll find out.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I also feel like, you know what, if the movies continue to be good, people will go see
them. And most of them have been good, you know. I mean, most of them have been. I mean, you know.
How was your experience gearing up? Well, first of all, going through Man of Steel, because we did a little press thing. We did some press stuff. I moderated some press stuff for you for
Can I just ask you a question about Man of Steel?
Please, go ahead.
Don't take it the wrong way or anything like that, but how could you – let Superman kill that guy.
Does anyone hit you with that a lot?
Yes, but for as many people as honestly hit me I get just as many people saying, awesome that you did that.
Right.
And so I think that that's a classic example.
But my question is to you, I guess less to you as a writer, I guess more to you as like a fan of comics and a fan of Superman.
Do you want a real answer?
Yeah, I would love to.
Okay.
I'd love to know.
So in that instance, like the way Chris works is you do what's right for the story. Mm-hmm. That exists entirely separately from what fans should or shouldn't think of that character, right? You have to do what's right for the story.
Okay.
So in that instance, this was a Superman who, A, had only been Superman for like a week.
Oh, if that.
Like he never, like, yeah, if that. He was not
He's
Superman.
He's a baby Superman.
He wasn't Superman as we think of him in the DC comics or the Neil Adam or the Kurt Swan or something like that. Or even in a world that conceived of Superman existing, he'd only flown for the first time a few days before that. He'd never fought anyone that had superpowers before, and so he's going up against a guy who not only is superpowered, but who has been training since birth to use those superpowers, who exists as a superhuman killing machine, who has stated, I will never stop until I destroy all of humanity. And also from a thematic standpoint, it was a story about a guy who's the last of his kind, who's given this opportunity to have his kind back, but it means he's going
to have to decide to.
So from if you take Superman out of it, what's the right way to tell that story?
Mm-hmm.
I think the right way to tell that story is if you take this powered alien who says you can have your race back, but you have to kill your adopted race. The moral horrible situation to be in is to actually be forced to kill, not wanting to, but mm-hmm. be forced to kill the only other person from your race and to sort of give that up. Take Superman aside. I think that's the right way to tell that story. The other thing is, how does he solve the problem? There's no prison on the planet that can hold him.
Yeah.
Our Superman in Man of Steel can't fly to the moon. Right. How does he?
He doesn't know how to fly to the moon yet.
What does he do? You know, anyway. So,
where's
so that's,
the Phantom Zone?
Yeah, exactly.
When you need it.
He blows really cool breath as it laserizes.
But the other bullshit thing is, like, go to the comic books, and he killed Zod a couple of times in the comic books. He killed Zod in the John Byrne comic books.
That's true.
I mean, is it possible that part of his – that, you know, like if you're a kid – you know, and you shoot a bird and then it breaks your heart and then you're like, oh, well, I'm not going to kill anything the rest of my life.
That was part of the point is there's a – you know, that film could have been called Superman Begins. That was a film in which he's been hiding.
That. That's a better name.
But you know, my point is like he's not Superman until like the penultimate scene of that film. And then he doesn't understand that he has this sort of – you know, people think of him in a certain way. There's no, like, Superman kills or doesn't kill kind of thing. That doesn't exist in this story yet. And we were trying to do, or within the framework of what it is, a relatively realistic story about what if this guy existed.
Yeah.
He could shoot a bird or a plane.
I'm satisfied with that answer.
That's a great answer. And also, it's interesting when you watch a universe that doesn't have – it's like watching Walking Dead and go, they don't know what zombies are. Or watching Superman and go, he doesn't have Superman comics.
See, people are trying to apply
– their history.
Like the way that Chris and I work is we don't do something because, well, that's the way the fans would or wouldn't like it. We have to follow the sort of truth of the story.
Yeah.
And so I don't know. You tell me how you should have solved that problem in our version, in our world.
God. Phantom Zone? Can't do it?
No Phantom Zone.
God damn it. There's no projector. It got destroyed when the ship got destroyed.
Oh, God. Shouldn't let that ship get destroyed.
But to be fair, we were trying to construct the story in such a way so that he had no choice.
Yeah.
We're trying to make it a Sophie's choice.
You don't think his super cool breath would have done anything?
He doesn't have super breath in our version.
Okay, well, that's not established. He doesn't try.
He doesn't know yet.
He doesn't know.
He's a baby Superman.
Yeah. You had him go, oh, man, my breath is he didn't even know he could fly. This is true. This is true. I feel like you put him up against that fight a little too early for Supes.
But I have had people say, well, he could have flown Zod to the moon. And I'm like, no, he couldn't.
Not in that. Yeah.
By the way, our Superman needs oxygen still. He could hold his breath for a long time, but not
how
forever.
Long? Tom Cruise did it for 4 minutes.
You know, Tom Cruise would have killed Zod.
Yeah. Oh, wait, no.
But I wonder if Superman especially, his powers also throughout all of Superman lore have never been fully consistent.
No.
Either.
No.
I mean,
not at all.
Especially if you watch if you watch the Brandon Routh version, it's like, how is he picking up an island of kryptonite? There's like, you know, in the
And by the way, and how is it not crumbling around him or how is it not physics.
In the Donner hard. Superman, they basically just put a necklace around him and he was about to drown, you know? Like
he reversed time.
He reversed time. I mean, like, once you can make the Earth go the other way. Because
I will say what I loved about the Batman vs. Superman latest trailer that came out after Comic-Con, what I loved about that was seeing Bruce Wayne running into the destruction.
Well, again, that was the whole point there was that awesome. It's like, oh, what happened in that movie? Because everyone's like, wow, there's a lot of destruction. We're like, yeah. and we're going to talk about it. Mm-hmm. Like, because it's like you're trying to follow things through to it's sort of logical. Like, it doesn't happen in a vacuum.
Yeah, but it's also like, I think like it's cool because like the audience reaction of that of Man of Steel was like, oh my god, there's so much destruction, all these buildings are going down, but you get to see sort of like, oh, that's how Bruce Wayne's going to deal with it.
But also, I know it's like, I know some people are like, oh my god, there's so much destruction. But our point was like, but there would be.
Yeah.
We weren't trying to tell a story that it's not in a magical world where like this happens.
Where he pauses mid-fight to save a puppy.
Or like all these buildings collapse and like somebody wouldn't be hurt. Mm-hmm. It's like we were trying to say, well, what if this really happened?
Yeah, it's like, it's kind of funny to watch like Superman 2. Where, you know, it's like they're throwing buses.
Which one? The Donner Cut? Or are we talking...
Not the Donner Cut. Okay. Like when Richard Lester took over and Superman 2 kind of became a weird comedy almost in a weird sort of way. But so many people would have died during that fight so many people would have died. And but it's the point where they kill Superman with a bus, quote unquote, and then then all the city people are like, they called Superman. Let's get him. And they're like picking up trash off the street to try to basically kill Zod.
Maybe it's like Vigo in Ghostbusters 2. What happens is when there's joy.
No,
but I will also say I admit to a little bit like if I think prior to that, to Man of Steel, to a certain extent, I think that in comic books the only time that they sort of accurately depicted what would happen if two super beings actually went head to head was in Alan Moore's Miracle Man, when he's fighting like Kid Miracle Man, and you know that was kind of what you think it would really be like, and to a certain extent we were doing a version of that, you know.
I want to. I'm gung ho on this fucking.
I want to make a
sketch.
I want to make a sketch. It's just the idea of the reality of Superman. I want to make a sketch where Superman and Lois are about to. They're about to get intimate for the first time, and she undresses, and then he undresses, and this crazy tentacle comes from out, and she's like, Jesus Christ! And he's like, well, I'm an alien. What did you think was gonna...
Oh, I think Ma and Pa Kent would have gotten
that. Have you ever read it? I'm sure you've heard of that. Larry Niven, the famous science fiction author, wrote a
about what would happen.
Yeah, he wrote an essay called "Man of Steel, Woman of Tissue."
Didn't Kevin Smith?
Kevin goes through that argument.
Kevin goes
through
that in Mallrats. Where it's basically like a shotgun blast.
Yeah,
because his molecular structure. So, but maybe. You know, maybe he can control that. Was that part of the argument? Maybe he can control it.
Well, maybe that's where his cool breath went. Maybe it'll freeze her.
He can cryo freeze
her. Or if he has like a Kryptonian Yoda that can tell him how to control it.
What are you excited about? I mean, I know primarily we're going to – and in a sec we'll talk about the Da Vinci's Demons. But really quickly, what are you most excited about with Batman versus Superman? Now that you know what's happening and you know, like, you, just being in that position where you said, oh, you know, I hadn't come out yet.
Honestly, I mean, I think the coolest thing is going to be a live action, big budget version of Wonder Woman. I mean, I think that's the coolest.
Yeah.
I mean, everything else is awesome, but I remember when we were first talking about doing that, that was just super exciting to us.
Yeah. And as the writer, how did you balance having...
One of the writers.
As one of the writers, how did you guys balance having multiple characters in the story but still keeping it focused and not all over the place?
There's very little that I can say about this film.
Just walk through us. Walk us through the plot. How's it end?
All right, start with Fade.
It's a it is a balancing act, no pun intended. I mean, you have to... You know,
balancing act. So Dick Grayson's in it. What's happening?
Yeah, Dick.
That's my subtle. You know,
read into everything.
David Goyer absolutely confirms.
Right. Yeah. It's a. Again, you just have to go back to like. I think the challenging thing about the DC films now, the post Nolan films, and the. The fun thing and the challenging thing is trying to say how can we – what we've chosen to do is portray it in a slightly more realistic way.
Right.
And so on one hand, that's really exciting because it opens up a lot of dramatic possibilities that you might not have thought of. On the other hand, it makes it harder, the suspension of disbelief harder, because you have to like – you can't just do things in any of these films because – you know, that's the way they did it in the comic books, mm-hmm. because we're trying to pretend as if these comic books don't exist.
I do. I love – there's a lot. I mean, there's a lot about that trailer I love, but I also love how it looks like Lex Luthor has been, like, Silicon Valley startup guy. Like, I love that. Like, on a basketball court.
Yeah, I think
like, it's fucking
awesome.
If you
think of who Lex Luthor would be today,
yeah.
it feels like he'd be more in the Mark Zuckerberg,
yeah,
you know,
for
sort
sure.
of – you know, IPO.
Good cast
know.
In getting Mark Zuckerberg.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, so good.
But also you have to think that a person like that to have achieved that level of wealth, right has to be charismatic,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, how could he not be charismatic? Yeah. Or it's like I always thought he was like a combination of like Zuckerberg or Elon Musk or somebody like
yeah.
that.
Well,
and I love
yeah.
Elon Musk. But he had to be charismatic in and of his own right,
yeah.
and also super smart.
I just met him a couple days ago.
Elon Musk. I've never met him.
I went to SpaceX.
He's like one of my heroes.
When you look at what that guy's done, it's
yeah.
fucking crazy. Like, if you had done even any one of those things,
I know.
That guy's a genius.
If you had had a cameo in Iron Man 2.
which I think was shot at where SpaceX is
yeah.
in Hawthorne. But, I mean... My God, you know, when you start looking up the other thing, and who knows everything, like where it all goes, but it's like, oh, he also owns like the second largest solar energy company,
Solar City,
yeah.
yeah.
I mean, it's really.
It might be the largest now.
I mean, it's like everything that he started. Oh, he got like $20 million for selling this. So then he put $10 million of that into this. And then that made $1 billion. Like,
but he keeps leveraging, but he also keeps taking risks.
He does.
Know? Like he's not just like sitting back and...
Risks on things that are not only for the good of humanity, but also like, oh yeah, how come someone hasn't done that yet? Yeah.
Listen, as soon as the fucking Hyperloop.
The Hyperloop.
I'm all about the Hyperloop.
The Hyperloop needs to happen.
I can't wait for the Hyperloop.
Hyperloop, that's a movie waiting to happen.
It's funny that you say that because a lot of what I do is sort of like near future science fiction or things like mm-hmm. that. And
yeah.
already on like six movies I've either asked to be involved in or have been involved in, it's like the production designer is like, and the Hyperloop exists. You know, and it's just like completely modeled after his current plan.
But Da Vinci's Demons, which,
yes.
which I think the premiere is October 24th on Stars.
Uh-huh.
So this is
third and final season.
The third and final season?
Yes.
Was that – did you say like I only want to do three seasons or I only have the energy to do three seasons?
No, the truth is I originally had a plan to do five or six and I mean it performed well. It performed much better overseas than it did here. And Stars here, they don't have foreign. So I think it had been in – I mean there's always a sort of like how well does it do? How much money does it make? I think if Stars had foreign, that would have been a slightly different calculation because it's done incredibly well overseas. And you know, we had 3 years of a good run. It is true Chris Albrecht at one point had said – because we had a plan to continue it, but it would have involved at least another two seasons to sort of do the next chapter after he leaves Florence. And so when we were – we did some reshoots, I think back in March. We did about 10 days of reshoots and Amy Berg, who's the writer I mentioned,
yeah.
sort of geek writer, was on it and she was with me on the reshoots and we didn't know whether or not we would have another season when we were doing it. So I do want, to the extent that there are fans out there listening, it's not like it just like ends and it goes off a cliff.
Mm-hmm.
We wrote some stuff and filmed some stuff that if it were the end, this is what we would do. So there's an end. And we when we got the news, we edited and put in these scenes. There are scenes that probably wouldn't have been in had it not been the end.
Oh, wow.
And so it's – I feel having said that, it's a pretty good ending. And it will feel like a sense of closure and it will feel circular like the snake eating its own tail.
Do you prefer – because I know you've done way more film than television. But do you prefer – having, you know, 8, 10, 12 episodes to draw
yeah,
a story.
Yeah, it's a blast. I mean, now, it used to be that I was like 10% of my energies were going into TV, but now it's about 50-50. And it just I like serialized storytelling, and there's so much amazing TV out there right now. I knew you know Scott Gimple well.
Yeah.
He was in the first writer's room for Da Vinci. He co-wrote episodes 2 and 3 of that. I mean, we just both love serialized TV. For me, that's the best possible way to tell a story is over the course of 30 or 40 or 50
And that's
episodes.
Kind of how films are going now, too.
It is. It's
like
weird.
Films are serializing.
I know.
Just to keep the audiences.
Yeah.
But I didn't know Gimple wrote on that. That's awesome.
Yeah.
That's
it was in between – it was a hiatus in between – I think it was second and third season. And he had like 6 weeks off, and I said, "Come."
Well, basically, the story is it's like a Da Vinci is essentially it's like Da Vinci Adventures.
Yeah, it's like one part Tony Stark, one part Sherlock Holmes, one part Indiana Jones.
Right, you
know? It's three good parts.
One part. Tales of the Golden Monkey.
Yeah,
anyone?
There you go.
Tales of the Golden Monkey.
I remember Tales of the Golden Monkey.
Those were
King Solomon's.
King, yes. Oh my God.
Richard Chamberlain.
Yes. Oh yes.
King Solomon's mind.
Everything that Indiana Jones wrought after that. We need more adventurer programming in the world. It seems like your calendar is pretty backed up for the next several years.
I'm good through probably 2017.
And are there any tiny little passion projects? You're like, oh, I just want to sneak away and just go make this weird little small. I mean, like, you make
yeah,
such,
there are there
you
are
make such big stuff now that it kind of doesn't. Wouldn't it feel? Oh, it'd be kind of nice just to make some weird little intimate movie where there's the stakes are low.
Yes, where I'm actually I partnered with a guy named Kevin Turin, who's a independent producer who produced movies like Arbitrage and All Is Lost, a bunch of really good films, and we're producing and I might direct one, and in some cases, writing. We're doing a little sort of mini slate of kind of under $20 million films, and they're not all genre films. Some of them are, and it's sort of like in some ways films that a lot of the studios aren't making anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a bunch of those that we're doing, you know, just because they're good for the soul, and if we make money on them, great. But that's not the primary motive. And there's an amazing one that we're going to shoot next year called Famine, about the Irish famine. Mm. And it's an amazing script that Jared Barrett wrote, and he's going to direct it. He's a really amazing Irish filmmaker. And yeah, that's not a money play. But it's an amazing script, and it's I think it's going to be a really amazing movie and an important film. So I don't know. We're doing – it's kind of like a one for me, one for them thing now.
Yeah. Great.
And is there anything that you can tell people about this process?
I wish we should do this in a year because I have two secret projects I'm involved in that I can't say anything about that.
Great.
We'll a year from now here. Will be amazing.
Secret Squirrel, the big budget live action.
Exactly. That are so cool, but I can't say anything.
Oh, nothing?
No.
Yeah, you can't. I mean, I could even try to poke you to get hints, but I know how much trouble.
An interesting one, because I'm working on the remake of Fantastic Voyage with Cameron. I mean, that's been announced. That's been really interesting.
Oh, my gosh. How's that? I mean,
he's the smartest, like, because I was like, that could be fun, but also just be fun to be in a room with him.
Yeah.
And
you mean the movie based on the Coolio song, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, good.
But that guy, he's just so smart, you know, that you're like, God damn, you're sort of as smart as you think you would be. You know?
And patient.
Yes.
Not afraid to, like, you know, not afraid to drag something along to make sure it's done right.
Well, yeah. What does he care? He's just sort of making it the way
he
wants
to make it. He can just walk into a room and go, oh, remember the highest grossing movie ever, Titanic? Well, like, I beat that, by myself.
Did that twice. Yeah. Probably going to do it a third time when the next Avatar comes out. I mean,
he's a smart guy.
Are you ever – do you ever get intimidated by anyone? Or at this point, are you like, I know what I'm good at?
Now, I'll tell you that the funny thing with him is like that. So lots of people are justifiably intimidated by him. And he's an amazing filmmaker. I mean, it's bookended by when I went to film school, I was at a screening of the first Terminator that he showed like 3 months before it came out. So obviously no one – we heard there was going to be this screening with an action movie with Arnold Schwarzenegger in it. And at the time it was like, this is going to be – a joke, you know, and he was speaking after the film and we watched it and everyone was just holy shit. And I got to talk to him afterwards for half an hour, 45 minutes of just, because he wasn't James Cameron.
Right. You know?
He was just a guy. And I reminded him, he didn't remember, but I reminded him of that I don't know, you know, 6 months ago. But it was funny. There was a moment we were sitting in this room, and there was a lot of sort of. It was the first time I'd met him recently, and you know, I think when someone gets that successful, whether they want it to or not, there's apprehension for the people around him. You know? And so we were sitting. I don't know. There was maybe five people in the room, and we were talking about story, and he suggested something, and because he's a big science guy, and I didn't think it would work from like a science standpoint. And I was like, do I say anything or not? And so I said, I'm not sure that works. And you could see like the air just like went out of the room. And then, but it was everyone else. It wasn't him. And he said, why? And I explained why. And he was like, yeah, that makes sense. Like, and you're like, I think it's just people are used to.
I thought it was a bad idea too, Mr. Cameron. Shut the fuck
yeah,
up.
Yeah, exactly. I just think it's I was like, I'm just, at the end of the day, I'm just going to like, do what I do, and then
yeah. I mean, I just, you know, just this idea of being sort of imprisoned by your success, you know,
that happens,
and being surrounded by people where you don't know.
It happens even if you don't want it to happen, right? Because it's like, you
know, no one wants to rock the boat or get in trouble, so you don't.
And I don't have even remotely that level, but I still really encourage the people I work with to just be like, tell me if you don't think it works. Like, it, like, argue with me. Explain why. You know, I just think you need that to remain vital.
You would have to, because at a certain point, you just go off in a really crazy direction and no one knows, you know?
Yeah.
You lose touch with people.
Or if you're successful in Hollywood, you know, at a certain point, people will be like, you know, we'll take anything you got, no matter how crazy. And it can be tempting to be like, oh, I'm going to do a story about something that's unproducible, you know, just because I can. And just because you can doesn't mean you should.
Well, this idea of kind of humanizing all of these characters and humanizing these people and bringing them more into reality is a really great – it's been really great. So
we're doing this I'm producing a film about Isaac Newton. And it's based on a real story. And for, again, another hero of mine, but it was a thing in history that I didn't know about, which is, you know, after he'd published the Principia or Principia, however you pronounce it. So he, at the time, he was super famous and he'd been knighted. He was about 50 and he was bored, and he actually suffered a mental breakdown. And, one of his friends, John Locke, like mm-hmm. the famous, yeah. not the lost character,
the philosopher.
But the philosopher, as a way of like getting him out of the doldrums, suggested that he become the warden of the mint, like, which is kind of a, just an official title. And so Isaac Newton moved to London, and he discovered that in that year, a third of all the English currency was counterfeit. And there was this really bad counterfeiting problem. And it turned out there was a group of counterfeiting thieves that were led by like this kind of mastermind. And he set about, he was given almost unlimited freedom and all these men at arms and to catch these counterfeiters and figure out who was behind it. And he, over like a 3-year period, he caught 28 counterfeiters. And they were all put to death, and there was this mastermind guy who was like the player on the opposite side of the thing. This guy named William Chaloner. Everything I'm telling you is true, and I didn't know this story, who was like the super genius of counterfeiting, who was really good at like social engineering. And Isaac Newton caught him, and at the trial, he boasted and said, I'm going to get off, and like they're never going to get me, because he paid off all the witnesses to not – he got away, and Isaac Newton caught him a second time and decided to be the prosecutor at the trial. And this guy, William Chaloner, was the defense attorney, and they went head-to-head. And finally, Isaac Newton got him and was, like, at his hanging. And I didn't – that story's true.
Wow, that's amazing.
But my point is, like, we talk about humanizing, like, these characters and, like – just the idea of thinking of this guy having a nervous breakdown and like then going into it and reinventing himself and employing scientific methods to capture these guys. And anyway,
it's like Untouchables meets Inherit.
It is. I love that stuff.
Well, thank you so much for being here. It's good to see you again.
Good to see you
too. And congratulations on everything, David. Enjoy your burrito, everyone.
Oh, I meant to ask you. It's like, do you actually know the derivation of the word nerd?
I'm under what? I'm under the impression that it was a Dr. Seuss reference.
If I own the zoo, yeah. Or if I ran the zoo.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's where it came from.
But it only came recently. It was like in the mid-50s.
Yeah, and then they use it a couple times in Happy Days, I think.
Yeah.
Fonzie would be like, look at these nerds.
Yeah.
You know, but it wasn't really until the movie Revenge of the Nerds where I really understood what that term
do you, was. And this is a real question. Do you think there's any differentiation between nerd and geek?
Not anymore. I think
was there?
I think etymologically there probably was. I think geeks were now I think there are some ideas where like, well, nerds are more technically minded and geeks are more pop culture centric.
Oh, okay.
But you know, I think previously nerds were more socially awkward as a function of their
repressed sexuality.
Repressed sexuality, inability to connect with mortals who were beneath them. And then but geek, you know, because the etymology of that word is geck, is a Greek word. It's like the people who would bite the heads off chickens at sideshows. I think geeks were probably more what dweebs are now. You know what I mean? It's like geeks were probably more like you didn't want to hang around them too much. Like nerds couldn't really hang around you, but geeks you probably didn't really want to hang around.
Right, right.
I think in the distant past. But I think ultimately we're all saying the same thing now. I think the lines have merged.
I just think it's interesting on nerds. I mean, obviously Nerdist, you've built a whole empire off of the word nerd. But my kids, I have three sons, and my oldest are 8 and 5. And they – like to say you're a nerd is like – like amazing. They think like nerds run the world.
Oh, it's great. Yeah. I mean, I'm so actually proud now.
Fucking dorks.
But we're not fucking dorks. I'm so proud now that I was growing up, it was a derogatory term, and now it's derogatory to challenge someone's nerd cred. Go, you're not a real nerd. Like, hey, come on.
When I was a kid, I was called a nerd, and that was like a really like oh man, they called me a nerd. You
damn,
know?
I'll never go to the dance now.
Yeah.
Anyway, I didn't.
A pleasure.
Now leaving Nerdist.com. Enjoy your burrito.